misfortune. He had employed someone who was already an intelligence asset on Kopech's payroll. When the asset informed Kopech of who Wojciech was and what he wanted, Kopech encouraged him to take the illicit job and further the relationship. Once Wojciech had fully implicated himself, Kopech had sprung. He had given the corrupt official two choices. He could be prosecuted and go to jail, or he could come to work for Kopech. The man had chosen wisely. He had gone to work for Kopech. It was a mutually beneficial relationship. Considering the side jobs Kopech took from time to time, like the one he was on for the Americans right now, a man like Wojciech was good to have on the payroll. Now, a leather Gurkha messenger bag slung from his shoulder, Wojciech made his way through Gorky Park, the oldest park in the city, named after the Soviet-era writer known as Maxim Gorky. Wojciech's psoriasis was flaring up. Even though he had slathered his body with ointment before leaving the hotel, the flaky patches of red skin had returned. They were inflamed and itched terribly. Though it was the stress, he blamed the weather. He hated it in Europe. He would have much preferred retiring to the Caribbean, or maybe the Florida Keys, but Kopech had forbidden it. Vacations? No problem. Permanent residency outside Poland? No way. The Polish intelligence officer lorded his power over him. Wojciech's life was not his own, at least not to the degree any free person would have desired. Though he lived comfortably in Warsaw, he lived as an indentured servant. Kopech could pull his passport at any time. Even more troublesome, he could turn him over to the authorities. Wojciech tried to keep that in mind and to find the bright side. His wife of 47 years had died the winter before. He had been by her side when she passed, rather than rotting away in a Polish prison cell. He saw his children and grandchildren on a regular basis. He came and went within reason as he pleased. It was a prison of sorts, but it could have been much worse. He thought about that as he strolled through the park toward the planetarium on the other side of the 56-meter-high Ferris wheel. It was a Saturday night, and the park was quite lively, packed with families and lots of young people. He could hear music and laughter all around. Kopech had sent him as a courier, his leather bag filled with American currency. He was to meet with his counterpart from Belarus, Pavel Kushner. Kushner had been chairperson of the Central Department for Combating Organized Crime and Corruption at the Belarusian Ministry of Internal Affairs. The pair had met quite by accident via a shared private banker in Switzerland. Certain financial synergies quickly became apparent. Within months, they had discovered a very profitable way to exploit the border between Poland and Belarus. That exploitation was why Wojciech had been sent to see his old friend and business partner. At the third bench before the observatory, Wojciech took a seat and unslung the messenger bag. Setting it next to him, he slid his hand beneath his coat and scratched at the painfully dry skin of his upper left arm and shoulder. Unfortunately, it didn't bring him much relief, and might have only made it worse. Fishing a flask from his interior coat pocket, he looked around to make sure he wasn't being watched, unscrewed the cap, and took a long pull of a spiced Polish liqueur known as kardamonka. Down the esplanade, he could see Kushner, slightly bent and in his trademark black trench coat, walking in his direction. Wojciech returned the flask to its hiding place and stood to greet him. The two men embraced each other, and then sat down.
"I'm sorry to take you away from your weekend," said Wojciech. "Thank you for coming back into town to see me."
"Our dacha is only an hour away," replied Kushner. "Besides, you said it was important, and worth my while."
Wojciech nodded at the Gurkha.
"The money and the photos are inside."
Unzipping the briefcase, Kushner looked inside.
"I don't know much about missile technology," he said, "but if your missing upgrade kits came into Belarus, there's only a handful of people who can move them. I know someone I can ask."
"How long do you think it will take?"
"Give me a couple of days. Where are you staying?"
"The Crown Plaza."
Kushner shrugged. "A little too brightly lit for me, but it's okay, I suppose. Would you like for me to arrange a girl for you?" No, said Wojciech. That isn't necessary.
Of course it is necessary. You're still a man, aren't you?
I am an old man.
So am I, but it doesn't stop me. There is an oyster bar not far from the hotel. I can get you a table. It will help you put some lead in your pencil. Or I have the blue pills if you need them. Viagra, the Belarusian said, mispronouncing the name.
Viagra, his friend corrected.
That's what I said.
Wojciech smiled.
No girls, no oysters, no Viagra. Thank you.
In other words, no fun.
All the Pole wanted to do was get back to his room and reapply his lotion. But that kind of personal information wasn't something he felt prepared to share. Rising from the bench, he left the Gurkha and said,
It was good seeing you again. I am sorry for interrupting your weekend.
It's always a pleasure to reconnect with an old friend, Kushner replied. If you change your mind about anything, no matter what you need, call me.
I will, said Wojciech. Thank you. And please remember, this is a rush job.
Of course, said the Belarusian. I'll handle it. Don't worry.
Smiling, the Pole shook his friend's hand and, turning, walked out of the park. As he made his way back to the hotel, he never even noticed that he was being followed. Chapter 39 Gotland. Sloane lingered at the hostess stand long enough for everyone inside to get a good eyeful. If Harvath had had any doubts about her talents, seeing the very discreet yet seductive way she handled herself would have put all of them to rest. After acting like a chatty American and having explained how she was working in Stockholm and had come over on the ferry for a fun weekend on Gotland, she was shown to a table by the hostess. She promised to be on the lookout for Sloane's friend and would bring her over as soon as she arrived. A few minutes later, a waitress arrived to take her order. O'Leary's specialized in American-style bar food, things like burgers, wings, nachos, and jalapeno poppers. She and the team had been on the road for over a month. A taste of home, even though she was on the job, would be a real treat. After ordering a Red Bull and a plate of wings, she settled back in her chair and took a look around. Sparman and his crew had all seen her come in. She had seen them too, though she hadn't let them know it. Even now, their eyes were still all over her. Pulling out her phone, she texted Chase to see how much longer they would be. Haney hadn't gotten there yet. Based on his estimate, they were at least 10 minutes away. Starting a new text, she gave Harvath a sit-rep from inside to let him know how things were going. Glancing up at Sparman and the Russians, she saw that their attention had shifted to one of the TVs, where a new soccer match was about to begin. The matchup appeared to be between Russia and the Czech Republic. Apparently, they were big fans of the sport, which she hoped would work to her advantage. If the game went well and they were enjoying themselves, it might provide her with the perfect opportunity. She knew plenty of women who would have said no to an operation like this. They would have been offended even at the thought of being used as bait. Sloane, though, didn't have a problem with it. She wasn't being asked to be part of a honey trap. Harvath had never asked her to do something like that, nor would he ever. He knew, without even asking, what her answer would be. He also knew why she was so determined to do this kind of work. Despite her parents' willingness and ability, Sloane had paid her own way through college via the ROTC program. She had attended Northwestern University, where she studied math and chemistry. She had grown up in an affluent household and had been a competitive figure skater through high school. Once she got to college, she had switched over to snowboarding, where she became not only more competitive, but happier. Where she hadn't been happy, though, was after college when she entered the army. The only reason she had agreed to sign up was that she was promised combat. She didn't believe in taking money for school and not paying it back as fully as she could. She did 2 tours in Afghanistan, during which she killed more enemy combatants than all of the other female soldiers combined. When word of her prowess leaked, a popular women's magazine back in the States did an unauthorized profile of her. As soon as Al-Qaeda and the Taliban discovered it, they placed a bounty on her head, and the Pentagon pulled her from combat. She ended up working with the all-female Delta Force unit, known as the Athena Project, but as a trainer, not an operative. While she was proud to be part of such a prestigious program, it continually pissed her off to see those women being sent out on assignments, as she remained behind at Fort Bragg. When Reed Carleton had offered her the opportunity to join his company and do all of the things she longed to do, she had jumped at the chance. In hiring her, he was putting into effect the same modus operandi Athena was. Take highly intelligent, highly accomplished, highly attractive female athletes, give them the same training as the men, and set them loose in the field. Women like Sloan were so successful, not only because they were good at what they did, but also because their beauty negated them as a threat. The simple fact was that when most men saw a good-looking woman, the blood flow to their brains got diverted to south of their belt buckles. Her looks were an asset, and she had no problem leveraging them. She could only do that, though, because she knew Carleton and Harvath valued her for everything else she brought to the party. The waitress returned with her Red Bull, and while Sloan waited for her appetizer, she scrolled through a series of news feeds on her phone. As part of operational security, the team wasn't allowed to check their social media accounts while they were on assignments. It was smart policy, which was Harvath in a nutshell. He was constantly hammering home the importance of good tradecraft. She also knew that good tradecraft could be the difference between life and death. Having been a hitter for so long, Harvath had plenty of those lessons to share. He knew his stuff. More important, he wasn't half bad at teaching others. He had helped her to become an even better operator, and for that, she was grateful. Looking up, she saw the waitress arriving with her wings. She was almost done with them when Yashinsky arrived. "Nice boots," said Sloan, as the hostess showed Yashinsky to the table. They were black and came up almost thigh-high. Her dress was incredibly form-fitting and left nothing at all to the imagination. "I think Harvath enjoyed picking out our outfits," Yashinsky replied. "No question. You look great, though." "Thank you. You too. What are you drinking?" Sloan held up her glass. "Red Bull?" "I'll have one as well, please," she said to the waitress, who had just arrived at the table. "How are the nachos?"
"Excellent."
"And some nachos then, please." When the waitress had walked away, Yashinsky looked over at the bar and said,
"So that's them?"
Sloan nodded. The Russians were a rough-looking bunch. They stood out like sore thumbs. Sparman, even with his red hair, resembled every other local in the place. Alpha dogs had a way of recognizing other alpha dogs, and Harvath had worried that if any of his male team members locked eyes with any of the Spetsnaz soldiers, they would have known something was up, and that would have been the end of it. Harvath wanted to maintain the element of surprise for as long as he could. That was why Sloan and Yashinsky had been sent in on their own. Returning her attention to the table, Yashinsky said,
"This is your show. I'm here to back you up, but only if you need me. We can get started whenever you're ready."
"We've already started,"
Sloan replied, as she glanced over and caught Sparman looking at her.
"And I will need you. But let's wait for your food first. Then we can kick this thing into gear."
Yashinsky admired the woman's cool and her confidence. She seemed not only ready, but also eager for what was about to happen. Chapter 40. Sloan knew exactly what she was doing. Dressed in the clothing Harvath had bought her, she was already fishing with dynamite, but clothing was only part of a successful seduction. It was a dance, a series of almost imperceptible cues, of motions, glances, and expressions. She did her best to ignore Sparman, only allowing him to catch her looking at him when she wanted to be caught. That was part of the game as well. She spent most of her time focused on Yashinsky, who acted as her eyes, telling her what was going on at the bar, and if her target was looking at them. Yashinsky knew the game and was an exceptional wingman. She knew how to dial her energy up, smile, and laugh. They were competing with the soccer match. It was important that they be more fun and more enticing. Soon enough, they had their answer. Sparmon left the bar, walked over to their table, and asked the two ladies where they were from. Harvath had already worked out the cover story with both of them. They gave the Swede the short version, after which he asked if he could sit down at their table and buy them both a drink. Yashinsky said yes, even though it was obvious that he was speaking to Sloane. Sparmon took a seat and called the waitress over. He ordered another beer for himself and asked the ladies what they wanted. They ordered Amstel Lights. There was no telling how long they would be drinking. The lower the alcohol content of what they were consuming, the better. Sloane elaborated on their cover story, going into more detail about where they were from and what they were doing in Sweden. When she asked Sparmon what he did for a living, he told her he owned one of the biggest ranches on the island. She said she didn't believe him and asked to see his hands. When he showed her, she lightly traced the lines and calluses with one of her fingers. If the man wasn't hot already, his temperature was definitely beginning to climb. And she had learned something about him, something he hadn't said. They finished their beers and Sparmon bought another round. They continued to laugh and make small talk. When the third round came, Yashinsky excused herself to use the ladies' room. While there, she texted Harvath a sit rep. Everything was going well, but Sparmon seemed content to just sit with a pretty woman, drink beer, and glance up at the TV whenever he heard his colleagues at the bar cheer or let out a collective groan. Harvath texted back that Yashinsky needed to get Sloane to dial up the heat. Yashinsky refused, telling him that Sloane was doing a great job and that he would just need to be patient. After leaving the ladies' room, she stopped by the bar to break a large bill so she could have money for the jukebox. One of the Russians was ogling her, and so she asked him in English if there were any songs he wanted to hear. The question seemed to have taken him by surprise. She could almost hear the gears grinding away in his head. The man's response finally came in a thick, unquestionably Russian accent.
"Bruce Springsteen," he said.
"The boss?" Yashinsky replied with a smile.
"Yes, the boss."
"I'll see if they have him," she said, as she accepted her change from the barman. Noticing the ink on the man's arm, she added, "Nice tattoo," before leaving the bar and walking over to the jukebox.
Springsteen, she thought to herself as she walked. Interesting choice, especially for a Russian. But that was the power of American culture. There were only a handful of Springsteen songs she actually enjoyed, and she was glad to see they had at least one of them. Inserting a bill into the machine, she made her selection. As she walked back to her table, the horns from 10th Avenue Freeze-Out began playing. It was obvious by the look on the Russian's face that he'd never heard it before. She flashed him a thumbs up. Confused, he flashed a thumbs up back. Laughing, Yashinsky sat back down.
"What's so funny?" Sparmon asked.
"The guy at the bar," she replied, nodding toward the Russian.
"What about him?"
"I asked what kind of music I should play. He said Springsteen. I don't think he knows this one. Maybe I should have played Born in the USA.
"His name is Nikolai. You should go back to talk to him," Sparmon suggested,
obviously trying to get rid of her.
Yashinsky looked over at the Russian.
"I don't know. He's not much of a conversationalist, and is even a little scary, to be honest. He's got a tattoo of a scorpion on the inside of his arm."
"No, he's very kind. He's in charge of the animals on the farm."
"You have animals? What kind?"
"Go ask Nikolai."
"Oh, I get it," Yashinsky replied. "You two want to be alone. Not a problem. I'll be at the bar with Nikolai, I guess."
"Thank you," said Sparmon, who was enthralled with Sloane and not even looking at Yashinsky. "Have him buy you a beer. Tell him I said so."
"I'll do that," she said,
standing up and stepping away from the table. She hoped that Sloane had understood her message. Sparmon's farmhands were definitely Spetsnaz. The scorpion was a popular tattoo in a lot of their units. Just as Monica had noticed the tattoo, Sloane had noticed that Sparmon had stains on his fingertips. As his leg bounced up and down under the table, she could tell he was jonesing.
"How long ago did you quit?" she asked.
"Quit?
smoking.
How did you know?
Sloane smiled coyly.
I can read your mind.
I'm in big trouble then, Sparmon said with a grin.
We'll see about that. In the meantime, answer my question. How long has it been?
I quit a week ago.
Very few Swedes actually smoke. Maybe 10% of the country. That's it. My mother, though, hates that I'm part of that 10%. I don't much care what she thinks, but whenever I see her, she bothers me about it. I thought it would be cool, the next time I see her, to be able to say I had quit.
Sloane continued to play coy. You may have quit a week ago, but have you been a good boy? Or have you cheated?
She drew out the word cheated, as if she was asking him if he had been sexually mischievous. Sparmon's grin broadened.
I may have cheated once or twice.
I have a secret, she said, beckoning him closer.
She playfully bit her bottom lip, as if she had been bad herself and was contemplating whether to confess. And then she did.
I quit 2 years ago, and I still cheat.
You do?
I do. When have you cheated?
Asked Sparmon, leaning in more closely and trying desperately to be suave.
There's really only two occasions when it happens. When I'm drinking, she replied, running her finger around the lip of her beer bottle. Or if I've had really good sex.
Though Sparmon tried to hide it, she could see his Adam's apple move in a quiet gulp. Not only had she hooked him, but he had swallowed the lure. It was time to reel him in.
You know what I would love right now? She asked.
In his mind, the Swede was saying, please say sex. What came out of his mouth, though, was,
I don't know. What would you love? To share just one cigarette? You and me? The way I look at it, it wouldn't really be cheating. Not if we shared it. Does that sound like fun?
Sparmon wasn't an idiot. His mother be damned. He was going to have a cigarette with this woman. He could get back on the wagon tomorrow.
It sounds delicious. Wonderful. Do you have any?
No, but I'll be right back.
Don't move, he said.
Getting up from the table, he quickly crossed to the bar and interrupted Yashinsky and Nikolai, asking the muscular Russian for a cigarette. The Spetsnaz operative must have known his colleague had been trying to quit smoking, because he rolled his eyes and made a half-hearted attempt at dissuading him. But as he really didn't care what happened to Sparmon, he removed a pack from his coat pocket and handed it to him along with a cheap plastic orange disposable lighter.
Thank you, said Sparmon, as he tapped out a lone cigarette and handed the pack back.
Take the whole thing,
Nikolai insisted in his heavy accent.
I only need one.
You never know,
the Russian said, with a conspiratorial wink.
Misha has two packs with him. Do not worry.
Thank you,
Sparmon said, clapping his hand on the soldier's shoulder and then returning to Sloane.
Ready?
He asked her, smiling as he held up the cigarettes. Glancing past him, she saw Yashinsky at the bar. Their eyes briefly met, but in that split second, the Polish intelligence officer nodded. Game on. Chapter 41 Sweden had some of the most restrictive smoking laws in the EU. Not only was it illegal to smoke in bars and restaurants, you also couldn't smoke immediately outside them. Smokers in the Scandinavian country ranked just below lepers. Not that Sloane minded. She had never been a smoker in her life. Seeing Sparmon's nicotine-stained fingers had been a gift. Pay attention to everything, another of Harvath's rules of tradecraft. She had worried that only the promise of a blowjob could have dislodged Sparmon from the premises. Fortunately enough, there was a craving stronger than sex, stronger even than cocaine. Smoking was one of the hardest habits to kick, and once a smoker, always a smoker. It only took the right combination of circumstances to relapse. In this case, all it took was booze, a little TNA, and probably the stress of Lars Lund's surveillance and subsequent murder. That is, if Harvath was correct and it hadn't been an accident. Like her boss, Sloane had been taught not to believe in coincidences either. As she and Sparmon left the restaurant and crossed the patio, she only had one lingering concern. How would Jashinsky get out? They hadn't had enough time to cover every eventuality. She had to trust that she'd come up with something. Right now, Sloane needed to focus on getting Sparmon into the minivan and getting the hell out of town without his Spetsnaz pals noticing. It was a very dangerous proposition and probably much easier said than done. The moment they hit the pavement, the Swede's hands were all over her. It started with one on her hip. When she didn't object, it quickly moved to her ass. Though this was part of the job, she made a mental note to make sure to squeeze some sort of pain and suffering out of Harvath for it. Smiling, she gently brushed his hand aside and began moving away from the entrance toward the minivan that she knew would be idling at the end of the block. Sparmon cooperated for a moment. Then he stopped and pressed her up against the wall, kissing her neck. Gathering up the front of his shirt in her fist, she brought him close enough to deliver a vicious headbutt, but instead gave him a peck on the cheek.
"Slowly," she cooed. "What's your rush? Let's go have our cigarette first."
Smiling brightly once more, she gestured for them, and Sparmon handed the pack over. As if she'd stolen the ball and was heading for the goal, she squealed and ran as best she could in heels down the sidewalk. Enjoying the game, Sparmon followed, growling and closing in on her with each step. At the end of the block, she ducked around the corner, out of his sight. Sparmon wasn't deterred. As she disappeared, he chased right after her, chanting, "Here, kitty, kitty, kitty." Coming around the corner, his chance instantly stopped.
"Hi there," said Harvath,
as the Swede came to a screeching halt right in front of him. Haney had brought back Chase and Stalin, who were standing next to Scott. Sloane was behind them.
"What the hell is this?" Sparmon demanded. "Who are you?"
"The Tooth Fairy," Harvath replied.
Stepping forward, Chase deployed his taser and let the Swede ride the lightning. Instantly, the man's muscles seized, and he fell to the ground. Harvath then gave the go command, and everyone sprang into action. While Haney backed the minivan up to their position, Stalin flex-cuffed Sparmon, put a piece of duct tape over his mouth, and pulled a hood down over his head. They had debated disabling the Spetsnaz vehicles, possibly by slashing their tires, but decided instead to make it look as if Sparmon had simply left with a woman he had met in the bar. If they went to the police, that was all they would be able to report. Patting him down, Sloane found his car keys and headed off to where she had watched him park. Harvath helped Stalin get Sparmon into the minivan and then told him and Haney to get back to the rental house. He and Chase would keep the Camry and join them as soon as they could. First, they had to make sure that Jashinsky got out of O'Leary's. As Haney and Stalin took off with their prisoner, Harvath pulled out his phone and texted a prearranged one-word code to Jashinsky.
"Bootsy."
Back inside O'Leary's, Jashinsky looked down at her phone, which was sitting atop the bar. Harvath's text had just come in. It was time to execute her exit plan. She had begun looking for ways out the moment she had walked in. It was one of the reasons she had gone to the ladies' room. Its windows, though, opened onto a small courtyard, framed by the medieval city wall. Without climbing equipment, there was no way she was going to be able to get up and over it. It was too tall. If they'd had time to prepare, perhaps she could have hidden a length of rope in a pair of athletic shoes, but they'd had to do this on the fly. As she had been trained in the army, she needed to adapt and overcome.
"Think," she had told herself, "what other ways are there out of here?"
Nikolai was interested in his soccer game, but he was also interested in her. If she got up from her stool, he would want to know where she was going, and despite appearing a bit brutish, he didn't come off as unintelligent. The Russian was paying attention to his surroundings, watching who came and went. Jashinsky had a pretty good feeling he had been keeping a mental clock on how long Sparmon had been gone as well. If he saw her walk out the front door, he was going to be very suspicious. He might even follow her. That couldn't be allowed to happen. The kitchen was her best shot. From what she could tell, it had a back door of some sort that opened onto a gangway that, she hoped, led to the street. The only problem was that the kitchen could be seen from where they were sitting at the bar. If Nikolai, or any of his comrades, saw her walk in there, they'd immediately suspect something was off. The key was to do it without their seeing anything. She needed a quick diversion. It only had to last long enough to get her into and through the kitchen. On her last trip to the ladies' room, she had seen just the thing. Swallowing what was left of her beer, she playfully teased Nikolai with the empty bottle.
"Buy me another?"
she asked, pretending to be a little more buzzed than she was. In the Russians' estimation, the beers were very expensive. Too expensive. Nevertheless, if he ended up getting laid, the investment would be worth it. The woman was attractive and had put her hand on his arm several times, which was a good sign. She also didn't talk too much. She seemed content to let him watch the game and talk with his buddies. She was almost too good to be true. Signaling the barman, he gestured to bring the woman another round. If he didn't end up sleeping with her, he could always insist Sparman pay him back.
"Will you excuse me, please?"
Yashinsky said as she slid off her stool.
"Where are you going?"
the Russian asked, one eye on the match.
"To the little girl's room."
The man looked at her, puzzled.
"The toilet,"
she explained. "Oh," said Nikolai, embarrassed, returning his attention to the TV.
"Okay."
Picking up her phone, she headed for the ladies' room. Once inside, she made sure she was alone and then unscrewed the pump for one of the soap dispensers. Removing the spring, she screwed the pump head back on and then uncoiled the piece of wire. Pulling up Harvath's message on her phone, she texted him back.
"Outside in 90 seconds.
"Good copy," Harvath replied.
"We'll be waiting."
Stepping out of the ladies' room, she approached the breaker box, opened the cover, and threw the breakers. Instantly, the restaurant was plunged into darkness. All the TVs cut out, as did the music. Shutting the box, she threaded the piece of wire from the soap dispenser through the area meant for a lock and twisted it as quickly and as tightly as she could. It wouldn't prevent someone from opening it, but it would slow them down. Leaving the circuit breaker, she moved as fast as she could in the darkness to the kitchen. Gotland was an island, and as with most islands in Europe, its inhabitants were used to suffering power outages. As a wave of annoyed groans rolled across the establishment, the staff hunted for flashlights while customers activated the lights on their phones. Yashinsky made it into the kitchen right before a beam swept over her. Taking out her own phone, she activated the flashlight and used it to light her way to the side exit. She was moving with such purpose that no one in the kitchen bothered to question who she was or what she was doing. Pushing through the door, she ended up in a narrow gangway between O'Leary's and the building next door. Seeing the gate at the end, she ran for it. She was only steps away when her eyes zeroed in on the chain and padlock. She'd seen enough security theater in her lifetime not to assume it was locked. Besides, if the restaurant caught fire, the gangway would be a death trap. Getting to the gate, she gave the chain a tug. It was definitely locked. Shit. The gray Camry had just pulled near the entrance. She could see its taillights. Pulling out her cell phone, she called Harvath.
"Back up 10 feet, she told him when he answered. "I'm in the gangway, but the gate is locked."
"Can you climb over it?"
he asked as he relayed the instructions to Chase to back up. The gate area was covered by a metal roof. It was likely meant to serve as a space where deliveries could be made and inventoried without threat of the elements. Yashinsky examined the space, but wasn't hopeful. The gate came up nearly to the underside of the roof. There wasn't enough room to squeeze in between. There wasn't enough room to go under it either.
"Think," she challenged herself once again.
The only thing in the gangway besides her and the locked gate were stacks of plastic crates used to haul beer bottles. They were her only hope of getting out. She was halfway through stacking them when Harvath materialized and began yanking on the gate. It didn't budge for him either.
"Hurry,"
he said as he disappeared from view. "Hurry," she repeated to herself. Did it look to him like she was taking her time? Starting with the highest column, the one that would allow her to hop onto the roof, she stacked the crates in descending columns, forming a makeshift staircase. It didn't have to be pretty, and it wasn't. It only had to work. Fortunately, many of the crates were already stacked up against the wall. All she had to do was drag them out and get them into place. With the last one set, she began her rickety climb. But no sooner had she begun than there was an angry voice from behind her in the gangway.
"Stop!"
it demanded. The voice belonged to Nikolai. When the lights went out, he must have come looking for her, and now he had found her, trying to escape. Running down the gangway, he charged toward her, shouting and cursing in Russian. She tried to move faster, but the crates were unstable and wobbled on the uneven cobblestones of the alley. The quicker she moved, the more unbalanced everything became. The Russian had reached her staircase now, and was kicking and ripping away the crates like a madman. He reached for the last stack of them a fraction of a second before she leaped onto the roof. Yashinsky knew she was going down before gravity had even taken hold of her. But before she could fall, she felt something grab her arm. Looking up, she saw Harvath, who had climbed onto the roof from the street.
"Give me your other hand," he said.
Reaching toward him, she did, and he pulled her the rest of the way up.
"We've got to move," he said,
pointing to the other side of the roof and the sidewalk below it.
"Hurry up and jump."
Yashinsky moved as quickly as she could to the opposite ledge, lay down on her stomach, hung her legs over, and dropped to the pavement. Looking through the gate, she could see that Nikolai had already run back inside. He would be on the sidewalk in seconds.
"Get in the car," Harvath ordered as he jumped down. "I'll catch up with you."
She did as he instructed, and her door wasn't even closed before Chase peeled out. Out the rear window, she could see Harvath running up the street in the opposite direction.
"Where's he going?"
she asked, as Chase pulled a hard right turn.
"He changed his mind. He's disabling their vehicles. We're picking him up at the next corner."
Accelerating up the street, Chase barely tapped the brakes to take the next turn. When they got to their rendezvous point, they could see Harvath running toward them, with the Russians in hot pursuit.
"Reach behind you and open the rear passenger door," said Chase.
Unbuckling her seatbelt, she leaned back and threw the door wide open. Seconds later, Harvath leaped in.
"Go, go, go,"
he commanded, slamming his door shut. Lying on the back seat, he focused on catching his breath as Chase punched the accelerator and got them the hell out of town. Chapter 42. Kaliningrad. The Rome bombing, despite his concern about moving it up, had gone off perfectly. It was exactly what his superiors back in Moscow had needed to see. It had also garnered wall-to-wall media attention. The fuse had been lit. Tretyakov could stop right now, and everything would probably take care of itself. But that would be leaving too much to chance. He didn't believe in trusting things to chance, especially for something this important. There were still many more things to be done. Chief among them was getting to the bottom of what NATO knew and what their level of preparedness was. Because the haystack fell partially within his jurisdiction, he was one of several people charged with finding those needles. Any intelligence operatives who delivered intel to Moscow that proved helpful for its Baltic invasion would be able to write their own ticket. They would not only receive rank advancement and state acknowledgement, but they would also be positioned to reap incredible financial benefits. Just as the punishment for failure could be extreme, so could the rewards for success. Sometimes, as much as he hated to admit it, the underpinnings of capitalism made sense. What didn't make sense, though, was who the American on the CCTV footage from Visby Hospital was. That was needle number one. Ivan Kuznetsov had received the footage from one of his assets on Gotland, a police officer named Johansson. The American had identified himself as Stephen Hall and had NATO credentials. But based on all of its NATO sources, Russia couldn't find anything on him. For all intents and purposes, Stephen Hall didn't exist. Tretyakov was certain the man was an intelligence operative, likely CIA or possibly DIA. He forwarded the footage to Moscow, where they ran it through all sorts of analysis and facial recognition programs. They thought they had a partial match with a piece of Al Jazeera footage from a few years back. An American soldier had been caught on tape beating a local man in a Middle Eastern market, but the comparison was inconclusive. Other than that, they had come up empty. The guy was a ghost. That only further served to convince Tretyakov that he was dealing with an intelligence professional, probably one who was very highly skilled. Flying a team into Gotland on a private jet was a big deal. NATO had money to burn, but not for run-of-the-mill personnel conducting site surveys for alleged training exercises. The local police might have bought a cover story like that, but not Tretyakov. The fact that the people on the plane were there to meet a Swedish intelligence operative, the same man who had Staffan Sparman under surveillance, concerned Tretyakov, and rightly so. Even though the man's death had looked like an accident, Tretyakov was now worried that they had been too rash. The Gotland cell was too valuable to lose, especially right now. Kuznetsov, though, had told Tretyakov not to worry. According to Johansson, the local chief inspector hadn't suspected anything. The worst thing that they could do at this point was to change their routines, or to start acting suspiciously. The beauty of the Gotland cell was that it wasn't trying to hide. It was operating right in the open for everyone to see. Tretyakov supposed he was right, but he didn't like it. What bothered him was not knowing what his opponents knew. If they had anything of substance, they would have rolled the entire cell up by now. Putting it under surveillance seemed to suggest that they were still gathering information. Tretyakov was willing to go along with Kuznetsov and let it ride, for the time being. He didn't want to be the one to tell Moscow that they needed to shut the Gotland cell down. There was too much riding on them. The second needle he had to deal with was the alleged Griffin missile upgrade kits. He used the term alleged because, like Stephen Hall, none of his NATO sources knew anything about the missiles, other than the fact that they were supposed to have been destroyed. By all accounts, there were no Griffins in NATO's inventory. But did that mean they didn't exist? Tretyakov didn't trust the Americans, not one bit. Therefore, he was willing to entertain the idea that they secretly, and in violation of the treaty, had either left in place or removed, and later smuggled back in, land-based cruise missiles in Europe. His issue, though, was that the level of secrecy that would be required for something like this was almost outside NATO's capability. America and its allies had always been obsessed with following the rule of law and the terms of their treaties. To take such a gamble was so far outside their comfort zone that the missing upgrade kits had started to feel like disinformation to him. Yet Russia's GRU and FSB had both received solid, separately sourced reporting on it. That's what really had made it difficult. If the corroborative reporting hadn't been there, it would have been much easier to brush the entire idea aside. But they couldn't ignore what had come in, including the report from the United Nations in New York City. The behavior of the American and Baltic ambassadors had all but verified the theft of the missile kits. Based on his sources, the search had moved from Poland into Belarus, Minsk to be exact. The presence, or lack thereof, of the Griffin missiles in the Baltics was a top-level concern for Moscow. They wanted proof, either way, and they wanted it ASAP. Tretyakov had activated a team in Minsk to observe the progress there, and had also been shaking down every contact he had in Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. The Rode mobile launchers used for the missiles were not vehicles that were easy to hide, nor were rumors of their existence. Somebody, somewhere, had to know something. In the meantime, Moscow continued to tighten the screws on him. They not only wanted answers, but they were also anxious to finish prepping the battlefield so that they could launch their invasion. They wanted him to capitalize on the success of Rome. More than that, they wanted him to improve upon it. They were focused on civilian casualties. Civilian deaths captured the media's attention. Once you had the media's attention, the public's followed, like a dog on a leash. The question was, how he would follow up on the Rome bombing. That attack had been perfect. It had also been unique on many levels. Replicating it wouldn't be easy. But if easy was what had been needed, there were many untold numbers Moscow could have called. He occupied the position he did because he delivered what others couldn't. He delivered the impossible. And, as he cleared his mind and decided which attack would come next, he realized there was no better word for it than impossible. Chapter 43. Gotland. Harvath took a good, hard look at Staffan Sparrman. Haney and Stalin had him tied to a chair in an equipment shed on the edge of the rental property. It smelled like gasoline and rotten wood. They had stripped him down to his soiled white underwear. His hood was still on. The cold had gotten to him. He had only been in the shed for a while, but he was shivering. There was a tarp in the corner. Harvath gathered it up and draped it over his shoulders.
"Staffan, listen to my voice," he said. "The worst of this can already be behind you. It is your decision. If you cooperate with me, you will be home in your bed before the night is over. Do you understand me?"
Harvath watched as the man slowly nodded.
"That's good. Now, before we get started, I want you to know the ground rules. Only a few kilometers from here, we also have your mother, the governor, in custody."
It was a lie, of course, but Sparrman didn't know that. All he knew was that he had been taken captive. Why wouldn't the same people have been able to do the same to his mother? This was Gotland. She didn't have police protection. There was no need. Harvath watched as Sparman's body tensed. As Harvath had suspected, despite the man's difficult relationship with his mother, he still cared for her.
"If you answer my questions truthfully," he continued, "no harm will come to her. Do you understand? If so, nod."
Again, the man slowly nodded.
"Good. Here's the flip side. If you lie to me, or if I suspect you are lying to me, whatever pain I make you feel, your mother is also going to feel. Is that clear? If so, nod."
Even more slowly this time, the man nodded.
"Good," said Harvath. "Let's give this a try. We'll start with something easy. You have Russian Special Forces soldiers working on your farm."
Instantly, the man shook his head.
Harvath drove the open metal contacts of Chase's taser into Sparrman's ribs and depressed the trigger. Sparrman's body went rigid as he cried out and wet himself again, the urine running down his left leg and onto the floor.
Harvath pulled the taser back and gave the man a chance to regain his composure.
"Did you see what happened in Rome, Staffan?"
The man's head lolled from side to side. There was a fog detainees could slip into. It was the brain disconnecting from the trauma being inflicted on the body. In essence, it was a psychological safe space. Harvath was having none of it. Drawing his open hand back, he brought it slicing down and slapped Sparrman hard on the side of his head. With the duct tape still over his mouth, there was only so much noise he could make. Raising the radio to his mouth, Harvath said,
"Taser the governor."
Immediately, Sparrman attempted to cry out and shook his head from side to side. Moments later, a distant woman's scream came back across the radio. Hearing it, Sparrman slumped.
"Are the Russians working on your farm?" Harvath asked.
This time, the man answered with the truth. He nodded.
"Are they Spetsnaz?"
Again, Sparrman nodded.
"Who's in charge?"
It was the first time he had asked something other than a yes or no question. With a tape over his mouth, Sparrman wouldn't be able to answer. Reaching under the hood, Harvath found the duct tape and tore it off. It was painful, and the Swede flinched.
"Who?"
Harvath repeated.
"Help!"
Sparrman screamed in Swedish.
"Someone, please, help me, help!"
Balling his hand into a fist, Harvath drew it back and hit him so hard in the side of his head that it knocked him and his chair over onto the floor. With the man on the floor stunned, or maybe even unconscious, Harvath took a moment to examine his hand. No matter how careful he was, Hitting someone that hard always hurt like hell. Why didn't they ever just cooperate, he wondered. Why did they always resist? What was the point? Until they told him what he wanted to know, there was no escape, no getting out. He was in charge. But how bad things would get was totally up to them. Yet they still fought. That was fine. Eventually, they all broke. All of them. Pulling the chair back upright, he gave Sparmon a few light slaps through the hood to bring him back around.
"Can you hear me, Mr. Sparmon?"
he asked. Beneath the hood, the man nodded. Holding up his radio, Harbath said,
"Good. Now listen to what is about to happen to your mother."
With that, there were a series of what sounded like distant slaps, followed by more of the same woman's screams. Though they were allegedly happening kilometers away, Sparmon winced and felt each one personally. Sloane was doing a very convincing acting job. Setting the radio down, Harvath looked at his prisoner. The tarp he had kindly draped across his shoulders lay on the floor. He was bleeding from beneath his hood. If Harvath had to guess, it was from his mouth or his nose, maybe his ear as well. He was shaking again from the cold. He was in bad shape.
"How much more will you put your poor mother through, Staffan?" he asked.
The man didn't seem ready to answer. That was fine by Harvath. Inside the shed was a large plastic bucket. Crossing over to it, he picked it up and brought it back over to where Sparmon was seated. Lifting the man's feet, he placed them inside the bucket. Then he walked over to the corner and retrieved a large gas can. Bringing it back over, he unscrewed the cap and held it under Sparmon's nose for several seconds. After affixing the spout, he began to pour, sloshing plenty of it over the Swede's legs and thighs. Some even splashed against the man's private parts. It stung like hell, and that's when Sparmon began screaming. Chapter 44.
"Are you going to cooperate with me?" Harvath asked. "Because if this is just another game, I promise you I will not be happy."
"I will cooperate," the man shouted from beneath his hood. "Please, it burns."
Harvath yanked off his hood.
"The sooner you tell me what I want to know, the sooner you can get cleaned up. Who is in charge of the Russians on your farm?"
"His name is Dominik Gashi," replied Sparmon.
Harvath studied him, watching for any of the ticks or subtle facial cues that might indicate that he was lying.
"And who is Gashi?"
"Will you let my mother go?"
"It depends on what you tell me. Who is Dominik Gashi?"
"He works at an animal processing plant here on the island. It's called Firstpak."
"What was your involvement in the death of Lars Lund?"
"Nothing,"
the man insisted.
"He was following me, so I told Dominik. He said he and the Russians would take care of it."
"Why would you report something like that to Dominik?"
Sparmon didn't answer. Harvath held up the taser.
"Listen to me, Staffan. You're sitting in gas, literally up to your balls. In addition to a shitload of electricity, this taser produces a real beefy spark. 19 sparks per second, to be exact. What do you think might happen if I have to tase you again?"
The Swede looked at the device, and then down at his underwear, his legs, and finally his feet, submerged in the bucket of gasoline.
"I report to Dominik as well," he admitted. "We all do. He's in charge of everything."
"Define everything."
"He controls the Russians. They only work on my farm as a cover. I assume they are soldiers of some sort. Then there are the rest of us, local Swedes, sympathetic to the cause."
"What cause?" asked Harbath.
"The Russian cause."
"Communism?"
Sparmon didn't answer. He didn't have to. Harvath knew that was exactly what he meant.
"How many Russians are on your farm?"
8,
said the Swede.
"Any non-Russians?"
The man shook his head.
"How many locals sympathetic to your cause or otherwise are part of your cell?"
6,
replied Sparmon.
"I'm going to want their names, occupations, and where they live."
"Promise me you will let my mother go. I will give you whatever information you want."
"This isn't a negotiation, Staffan," Harvath reminded him. "Every single thing that happens to you is completely within your control.
If you cooperate, everything will be fine. If you don't, then you'll see what happens. That's the last time I'm telling you.
Tucking his taser in his back pocket, he pulled out his phone, activated the voice memo feature, and holding it up said,
"Now, let's have those names."
Sparmon rattled them off.
"Marcus Larson. He works for one of the Gotland radio stations and lives in Visby. Henrik Eriksson is an auto mechanic. He lives and works in Hemsa. Ove Ekstrom lives in Tofta and is unemployed. Ronnie Linderoth is a handyman and lives in Klintaham. Hasse Lustig works on the ferry and lives outside Visby. And then there's Magnus Johansson."
"Police officer," a voice interrupted from the doorway of the shed. "I also live just outside Visby." Harvath spun. Standing there, with his service weapon drawn, was Johansson, the same cop Harvath had seen driving past in Old Town earlier that night.
"Drop the phone," the officer ordered. "Hands in the air. Keep them where I can see them."
Harvath, who had been in the shed alone with Sparmon, did as he was instructed.
"How did you know we were here?"
"The car rental agency gave me descriptions of your vehicles," he replied. "Someone thought they had been seen near the Sparmon farm, but we couldn't confirm that. Tonight, though, I saw your Camry parked in Visby."
"I placed one of these inside the wheel well," he said, holding up a small, inexpensive GPS device. "When Staffan disappeared from O'Leary's, Nikolai called Dominic, and Dominic called me. This was the first place I came. When I heard him cry out for help, I knew I had done the right thing."
"And he probably alerted everyone else in the cell that he was coming," thought Harvath. "At least the Spetsnaz team with their vehicles disabled won't be able to back him up anytime soon."
That didn't change the fact, though, that Johansson had the gun, and thereby the upper hand. Harvath had to think of something quick. Sparmon was blabbering at his comrade in Swedish, probably telling him he wanted to be untied so he could rinse all the gasoline off his man parts. Johansson said something back and then looked at Harvath.
"Turn around, slowly, and face away from me," he ordered.
Harvath obeyed.
"Now, place your hands behind your head and get down on your knees."
Harvath didn't like the "get down on your knees" part. The cop was either going to cuff him or put a bullet in the back of his head.
"Do it," Johansson ordered.
Clasping his hands behind his head, slowly, Harvath lowered himself to his knees. He heard something being scuffed out of a leather case, and then the rapid, unmistakable click-click-click of handcuffs being prepared. But then, suddenly, as if Johansson had changed his mind, there was the sound of a pistol hammer being cocked. Johansson, though, carried a Glock, and Glocks didn't have external hammers.
Chapter 45.
"Very, very slowly," said Yashinsky,
who was holding one of the team's Sig Sauer pistols.
"I want you to holster your weapon. Do it, now."
Johansson did as she instructed.
"Lock it closed and snap the retention strap."
He did that as well.
"Now drop the handcuffs, kick them back toward me, and place your hands on the back of your head."
Once the police officer had complied, she told Harvath he could stand up.
"Nice to see you," he said to her. "Just out for a walk?"
"You're welcome," she replied.
"For what?"
"Saving your life."
"I guess that makes us even," he said with a smile.
Approaching Johansson, he got right in the man's face and said,
"There's only one thing I hate more than the Russians."
"Really?" the man foolishly replied. "What's that?"
"A dirty cop," said Harvath, driving his knee into the officer's groin.
As the air rushed from his lungs, he dropped to the ground, doubled over in pain. Harvath then punched him behind his right ear, laying him the rest of the way out. Collecting the handcuffs from Yashinsky, he cuffed Johansson and used an outdoor extension cord to bind his ankles and hogtie him.
"Check his phone," said Harvath,
as he removed the man's duty belt and cast it off to the side.
"I want to know everyone he has called or texted over the last 2 hours."
Patting him down, she found Johansson's iPhone in his coat pocket.
"It's locked," she said.
Grabbing the man's right index finger, Harvath bent it back so far and so fast it almost snapped.
"Here," he said, as the man cried out in pain. Try this.
She placed his finger on the sensor pad, and the phone unlocked.
I'm in, she said.
Scrolling through the call logs, she could see that he had talked with someone named Dominic twice in the last hour. The most recent call was 10 minutes ago. She shared the information with Harvath.
What should we do?
She asked. Harvath duct-taped both men's mouths and replaced Sparmon's hood. Picking up the radio,